This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. And welcome to the airwaves with us.
The air is really waving today, too, if you notice.
It's all around us.
Well, it's springtime. Springtime is the time of year when I think the most just gratefully about seasons, about the fact that seasons change. It's my very favorite new beginning of a new season. And so this morning I've been was kind of reflecting on seasons and cycles on all levels. There's the seasons outside, and then there's the seasons we go through in our just everyday life and growing as a person, and there's also the seasons and cycles in the life of an artist. And because I've been thinking about planting a garden lately, I was sort of thinking about the life of an artist with a garden metaphor, and how, like a garden, it's not a linear, our creative process is not a linear process. It goes through cycles, but there is a linear aspect to it, just like planting a garden, where you have an initial concept of what you want to do with a piece of land, and you plant things and they grow, and then the seasons go around and everything changes. And then the next planting cycle, you may take out some things you put in before and put in something completely new. Other things are in a different state because they've gotten bigger and they've matured and all that. And so the process repeats itself in gardening, and it also grows over the sequence of years. And I think the same thing happens in our studio when we're working as an artist, and within ourselves, in our own way of approaching our creative process. So that was, I thought that would be an interesting topic to discuss today.
Well, I guess I go through phases in the creative process. I often find myself scribbling in a notebook for a while and doing diagrams and drawings or writing phrases, depending on whether it's a sculpture or a writing project. And then at some point, I can't do it with scribbling anymore, and I have to start building something or make a prototype or bend a piece of metal or cut a piece of wood or start writing paragraphs. And then that leads to sort of either a pile of rubble that's almost something, or a pile of notes and files and stuff that are almost something. And then this kind of the next stage, I guess, is pulling it all together, where you've got something, but it needs to be marshaled and coordinated. Excuse me. And then there's a polishing period, which is kind of the easiest because it's already done and you're just doing manual labor.
And then during all of those other stages, though, do you circle back to the notebooks?
Yeah, I go back and forth. I go through all of the stages many times on any given project. And my projects are so eclectic that, you know, there is usually at least three going on at once that are so different that they don't consume the same resources, but they go through the same kind of cycle.
That is, because we're talking about a cyclical process of creation, mm-hmm. which is a pattern that you go through, and it follows this path. Is when one is rising this way or waning that way, does another mm-hmm. one rise up? Do they kind of, when you have two or three things going together, are these processes?
They seem to be completely independent. It's like once I'm in the notebook stage on one thing, I could be in the notebook stage on two or three other things. Usually, I guess what happens is if I've really finished something, like if it's an installation at Icon and it's done, you know, towards the show opening, there's only one thing that I'm doing for, you know, days or weeks. And once that's done, then it's sort of like, you know, the new year starts and I begin with the notebooks. And in the notebooks, I'll probably have 10 projects that I've sort of started. And then two or three of those will start to pick up speed. and they'll all go at different speeds. So they'll get out of the notebook stage at different times, and so I'll have things at all stages after a while.
So that goes right back to the garden metaphor. When you plant your seeds in the garden on the same day,
right, they don't all grow at the same rate.
Some of them sprout earlier than others, and they have different ways of sprouting and all of that, and need to be tended to in a different way.
Yeah. Do you ever take a break to stop the actual creative process and
No.
I did this winter.
I think that people do. And I think people's creative activities often run parallel to the actual seasons. You know, there'll be times of letting it off and reflecting.
But if I go for more than a few weeks without producing something, I start to feel sick.
I used to feel that way. I didn't feel sick. I used to feel pressured. I used to feel this like tremendous kind of pressure to keep expressing, keep expressing. And this winter was unique that way for me. Mm-hmm. And it happened from something outside. It was my daughter and her boyfriend came to visit from England and stayed at my house for 2 weeks. So my whole schedule was kind of slipped into their schedule, which was sleeping late and, you know, having like long leisurely breakfasts at 11 o'clock in the morning and, you know, sort of hanging around the house. And something changed inside me that made me realize that I deeply needed to have a rest period in my creative process. So even when they went back home, I took quite a while, about a month actually, after they left, to reflect, basically, and just, I would sometimes go in my studio and fiddle around a little bit, but that pressure and intensity was just absolutely gone during that month, and I felt inside like a newborn baby almost. And there was a quote that came back to me from the Tao Te Ching that I always loved. It's actually two different quotes, but I always put them together. One of them is, racing and hunting madden the mind. And then the second one is, can you be as supple as a newborn babe? And that's what I felt had happened. I felt like I had shifted out of this racing and hunting to be as creative as possible to this natural, more supple state that I needed to go to. And now it's revving up again. The creative urge and my projects and everything, they're just kind of naturally beginning in more the form they were before, but with this new supple quality that I didn't have before. So it was worth it.
Well, I think all artists have cycles. I mean, even the daily cycle. Mm-hmm. Some people don't. They have to sit around and drink their coffee and reflect before they attack the canvas in the day. And some go at 3 a.m.
For me, it depends entirely on what kind of momentum I've got going in a particular project. If there's something, and of course, if there's a commitment, if there's a show opening, then that's, you know, the show must go on. My theatrical background is absolute about that. You cannot, nothing can prevent the show deadlines from happening. But, you know, normally if I'm building something and I don't know how it's going to work and I haven't invented it yet and I don't know if it's going to work at all, I'll hit dead ends in the design process and I don't know what to do next, and then I just have to wait till something comes up in the notebook again. But if I've got something started and it's going to take 5 days of fabrication to make it happen, then each day is just, oh boy, I get to go on with what I was doing yesterday. And it's, you know, it's fun to have the momentum, but it's also, you know, it's leading up to something. And the, I guess for me, the rest period is just the delight of actually knowing that I've built something, that it's done. And there's a tremendous satisfaction in the it's done phase. That energizes me.
That it worked thing, for it, whether it ever goes to the show or not. If something works, then there's a kind of like a time to enjoy what one has manifested.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and the
there's
momentum.
All kinds of cycles involved, we're realizing here.
Yeah. This is a very many layered topic, because the momentum that you were talking about, I'm going to keep going back to this garden metaphor because I really like the way it's appropriate for this time of year and everything, and it really works for this. As you're in that field of momentum, it's like once you plant a garden in the spring, the season itself and the changes in the plants makes you have to have that momentum.
Right.
It's like your deadline of the show. You have to get it done by a certain show because, you know, things get dry. You have to water them in the garden, and weeds grow, and you have to take them out. So no matter what your conception is, you have to also interact every day with what the day brings. Your work, Alan, if it's based on machine parts or something like that, or things you have to glue together, you have to wait till the glue dries. You have to obey the properties of all
takes
the
days.
Pieces of material, you know, in order to. So there's there are those kind of cycles too that you have to.
When I did the sphere for the Ashtanga Kosh installation at Gallery 51, it involved covering a wire armature that had been stapled onto a polyethylene sphere that I made, and it had about 3/4 inch of vinyl based paper mache on the outside. And in order to get that to dry, what I had to do was close off my kitchen with 2 electric space heaters in the kitchen and a big fan so that I could keep the kitchen at about 100 degrees for 3 days. And there were fans blowing and stuff in this gigantic sphere propped up in the center of the kitchen. So it ruled my entire life because I couldn't make food for myself without going into the kitchen, which had been converted into a low temperature kiln.
There's something kind of mythic about that.
It was
great,
yeah. And what it was just this idiotic sphere. There's this big spherical thing sitting in the middle of the room with everything pointed at it. It was like some sort of, you know, energy sucking monster from another dimension.
Which brings up the thing of, I think, the last program, which is this dynamic that goes on between this desire to express and the resistance that you run into. And I think the weather and the days and the cycles, I think in that other show, one of the shows we did recently, we were talking about the environment and the influence of the environment. I think the environment is a much bigger, and the weather and the climate.
Yeah, there are just
the
some
people
days
and everything
you
else
can't
around
do
you. Very much influences how the work is going and what your mood is and what your inspiration is and the flashes of clarity and cognition that you get.
Well, and some people actually, like my mother, can't stand rainy days. She really feels down on rainy days, and
that.
She really needs sun to. And when it's sunny, she's like just a bundle of energy. And I'm in a way just the opposite. On really hot, sunny days, I feel like I'm under a spotlight, almost like a police spotlight. You know, it's like, it's too much, too intense, too light. Whereas on rainy days, I feel very soothed, like I'm allowed to work a little more slowly and be more mellow, and balances me out somehow.
I think it would do artists in general as part of their education well to reflect more on where they're doing their work and what
and
how
get
it's the
to
influence
know,
that it has.
Yeah, get to know your influences. Get to know what it is that puts you in these different modes. Because there are some days when everybody I know agrees can't do anything today. I mean, yesterday, I'm not specifically yesterday, but you know, you run into somebody and you'd be saying, God, yesterday I just couldn't even get started. And they'll say, yeah, I couldn't either. And you find that, you know, there's a dozen people in your circle of friends who all just yesterday was a total non-accomplishment.
Barometric pressure.
Yeah, it was something.
I remember when I learned about barometric pressure in school, it's like, wow, Something like that. You can't even see, but it affects our moods.
Can't feel it or anything.
That's not fair. That was my reaction to it back then. Wait a second.
Well, and if you, they've done studies of people who get migraines, and they find that there are like waves of migraines that go through a community, and they don't seem to correlate to anything. And yet these people who don't know each other are having them at roughly the same time. And as a result, they've concluded that climate change in some perhaps, you know, not measured dimension is what's bringing them on.
And lighting conditions, we were talking about days and rainy days, but I knew somebody who had some artistic mentor who said, all right, go into your studio and work with the lighting the way it is, and then the next day, or maybe it was in the same day they were supposed to change it, but change the, like, add another lamp or get a dimmer switch and change it just ever so slightly each day, and see how you feel, and see how you feel. Try different lamps and different kinds of lights and place them differently and see how you feel. And sure enough, at a certain point, this artist found that the lighting got to a certain condition that just made her feel tremendously good.
Yeah, yeah.
And she felt excited every time she went into her studio with the lighting.
I think that's totally vital. I mean, it's it's like the influence in a theater, you know, the lighting is a huge component in a theatrical production. And everywhere else except the gallery, the lighting is just incidental. I mean, you have these big panels of fluorescent lights in the ceiling, and everybody just accepts it. And they don't wonder about whether it has any effect on them. I remember going into stores that had ultrasonic burglar alarm systems that they left on all day long. They just didn't activate. But that meant that everywhere you went inside this gigantic store, there was this high-pitched, you know, ultrasonic whistle that you're not supposed to be able to hear. Well, I was young and I had good hearing, and I could hear it very, very easily, and it was driving me nuts. And at least half the employees in the store were younger than I was at that time, and they're just going around, you know, getting this shrieking whistle burned into their brains the entire time they're at work, while standing under these flickering greenish fluorescent lights that you sort of, after a while, your brain says it's white, but it isn't white, and it's a shade of green that's really weird, and nothing has shadows because the light's coming from all directions, and there's no three-dimensionality to things, and everything is also excessively bright, and it's insane to think that doesn't have a profound effect on people.
Well, in the Japanese, people are very conscious about placing shadows in their environments because it's like an art form in itself. There's a beautiful book. I can't remember the name of the book. Shadow is in the title of the book. It's a classic Japanese book. And it goes into great detail about when you're arranging things in your house, about placing objects, plants, whatever, the placement of windows and everything, so that the shadows create a beautiful aesthetic effect in the room.
Yeah.
I just love that.
So we're talking about the influence of the environment. And in this world today, we have the natural environment, which a lot of people have to escape to feel like the edge of things and kind of calm and clear, and just the changes of the seasons and this type of thing. But now that we're getting into lighting, we're actually getting into the sea of man-made stuff that we're exposed to, and that completely affects what's happening within our own awareness. That means imagery, the radio and television, and I mean, there's a sea of stuff that we're moving through if we're living in a city at all, or even in a home, and it's got radios and it's got newspapers,
invisible
and magazines
stuff.
And,
you mean that we're
no, I'm not talking about no. I'm not about the invisible. I'm That's what we haven't addressed yet in the show.
The electromagnetic fields and all of those things.
No, well, I mean, other, the subtle intelligence inside of things. We could, there's a show on that one, too. But I'm just talking about the sea of sensory imagery, especially, and then moving imagery and sounds and all of this. I mean, I think what I thought of was you were talking about the light. I was thinking, well, and then there's the sounds, the music that's being played.
Well, my sound seminar, you know, one of the things I was trying to get across was that we are immersed in a volume of a volumetric ocean of sounds that never stops, never, ever stops. And yet, you know, we hear relative silence and call it silence, and we hear relative quietness and think of it as being nothing, but it's very much something. The reverberation of my voice within this room is going on even when I'm not speaking, and we're hearing that, and we're hearing the traffic out in the street, and we can tell that the street is wet because there's a swishy sound that isn't there when it's dry. And there are people clumping around upstairs, and there's ventilation systems coming on and going off, and there are little hums coming from the lights. And we're hearing all of that, plus the sounds of our own bodies operating and the hiss of the hearing system itself, which actually hisses a little bit when it's not doing anything else, and the thumping and swooshing of the blood flow near your eardrums and the heartbeat. And these are all influencing us, and that's not even, I mean, I was excited about talking about that because people don't think about that much ever. The visual input, which people do think about quite a lot, is even more, you know, intrusive, and it's everywhere, and it's not just abstractions that we aren't noticing, it's specificity that we're, you know, sort of forced to tune out almost consciously, and we are inundated by it. You can't look in any direction without seeing text, without seeing words printed in some form. And I mean, I go to I get to the point sometimes where I take the brand names off of the products that I have in my house. When I stare at my TV, I don't want to be staring at the word Samsung all day. Every time I look at that thing, so I have black tape over it. I don't see that brand name.
I had a boyfriend back in art school when I was at RISD who he took art paper and put it on top of like his deodorant can or shampoo bottles or anything so that he could create his own
I just peel the labels off.
Look in the bathroom.
If you went into my bathroom, you'd see that none of the stuff on my counter has any brand names on it. They're all peeled off.
As you were talking about the visual input, I also thought about the influence of color. And this is something that has, like, I think many layers to it. There's like the color of different seasons outside, you know. Springtime starts to get green, but it's a different green than the green of summer, and we feel that the white of gray of winter and the autumn colors affect us. But I think we also go through cycles in our lives where we sort of need different colors to heal us or balance us out or inspire us or something like that. You ask people what their favorite color is, and at different times of their life, it's probably going to be a different color that appeals to them. And you drive, you go on a drive through any part of the country, and you go through like the strip that's there in every community where you have all the fast food places and the you know, convenience stores and things like that, and all the colors are these like dramatic primary colors, and they hit you in a certain way. And then you go through older neighborhoods where you have like subdued colored houses and brick and stone and things like that, and you go to Paris where they very, very consciously have planned the city with a color scheme in mind. So the limestone buildings, they almost look like they're all washed in the same kind of tea or something. And that neutral background is there with the way that they've painted the doorways of cafes in these beautiful colors that all seem to go together in the neighborhoods. And so you feel a different way when you're in that city than you do in some Las Vegas or something, for example. Yeah. And a lot of it is simply just the color bathes you in a different mood.
Wouldn't it be great if we could adopt a sort of very general, non-oppressive municipal style for the square here in Fairfield?
I'd like to be on that political meeting.
Yeah, can you agree on these ideas?
No, we've all discussed this, and we would love to have some theme.
You go to Santa Barbara, and they don't allow McDonald's arches in town and things like that. And, of course, everything has to have, you know, terracotta tile roofs.
And they can't go above a certain height.
There's some unity of architecture in a town like that.
Yeah, and a little bit of that here would go a long way.
You can overdo it, though. I think Santa Fe overdid it, you know.
I think Santa Barbara overdid it, too.
Yeah,
I
mean, to make it overly consistent, and then it starts looking artificial.
It gets into the nature of the American individuality and all of this stuff, because what we have in America is very American, in that we've got a Tudor house here, and then we've got a modern here, and then we've got this quirky postmodern thing here, and it's unity at all on a block. In the Midwest here, in these small towns, there seems to be some unity. But in Southern California, you'll see like an amazing array of sensibilities all put together. Yeah. And it's a very American thing, the individuality.
Well, you can do that well, too. And it's not just an American thing, because even like in Paris, where they have this seeming consistency, you walk down a certain block and there'll be a cafe that's like, hasn't really been changed for 100 years, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like preserved in its vintage state in a beautiful way, in a careful way, and then right next door to it could be, or two doors away, could be a ultra-modern, sleek cafe with like black and silver and red lighting and everything.
So tell me this. I have a feeling that there's some unity to where it's coming from in Paris.
Yeah, that's what
I'm
saying.
But I don't feel it in parts of Southern California somehow. Yeah.
I think it's a consciousness that is built into the culture of, you know, aesthetics are very important.
Yeah. Well, it's the difference between harmony and uniformity. You can make Santa Barbara as uniform as possible, but you could also let people go wherever they want in any direction, provided that there is some sense of harmony in the relationship to the rest of the town. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would hope we could do, that the buildings around the square don't all have to be painted the same color. And I think it's wonderful that some of them have become very colorful and almost garish, because it's individuality and it's fun.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.